Lecture 11, The Quest for Troy.
In the previous lecture, we talked about how the classics were an essential part of every educated person's background in the mid-19th century, as were the scriptures. But the question was asked again and again, particularly about Homer, was, were the Iliad and the Odyssey the historical truth? Had the events in these epics actually happened? In this course, we've talked about some remarkable figures, but none of them really are more colourful than the gentleman who is the subject of the next two lectures, the German businessman turned archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann, who made millions in the dye trade that indulged his obsession with proving that Homer's Iliad and Odyssey were based on actual historical fact. The second part of the lecture deals with his actual archaeology. We talk about his early career first, and then we get into his career where he became an archaeologist, he retired from business, and met a local diplomat called Frank Calvert up in Turkey, who planted in his mind that the mound of Hissarlik by the Dardanelles was in fact the site of the Homeric city of Troy, besieged by the Greek armies. We describe his large-scale excavations, examine his claims for the identifying the Homeric city, and describe the suspicious circumstances which surround the celebrated treasure of Priam, said by Schliemann to come from a single spectacular find at Hissarlik. And finally, we learn how Schliemann took the advice of a new generation of excavators at his latest excavations at Hissarlik. Heinrich Schliemann, who was born in 1822, towers over 19th century archaeology like a colossus. He's a figure, even today, who seems larger than life, which we suspect is exactly what he intended. Whatever the facts of his earlier career, which he himself clothed in myth, Schliemann's obsession with the historical truth of the Iliad and Odyssey led to the discovery of the site of Homeric Troy at Hissarlik on the Dardanelles, and also of the brilliant Bronze Age Mycenaean civilization. Heinrich Schliemann was born to great poverty. This much is true. At the age of 16, he was apprenticed to a grocer in northern Germany, a job where it is said he heard a drunk reciting Homer and became obsessed for the rest of his life with the writings of the great Greek poet. In 1842, and this may be where his ambition kicked in, because clearly he was burning with an ambition to get away from his conditions of grinding poverty, he became a clerk to a house merchandising dye in Amsterdam. This was a job which required him to handle different languages. Now, Schliemann was one of these very rare people, like Henry Rawlinson, who had a brilliant gift for acquiring languages. By the end of his life, he had mastered not only ancient and modern Greek, but half a dozen European languages fluently. He was capable of giving public lectures in English, German, French, and other tongues. He also mastered Russian. The company of merchants who he was with did a great deal of business with Russia. They particularly handled indigo, which was a commonly used dye in the 19th century. And very soon, Schliemann so impressed his masters that they appointed him their representative in St. Petersburg in Russia. But Schliemann was ruthlessly ambitious. He soon set up business on his own, and in quick order made a fortune in the dye trade. He was a millionaire very rapidly. He then made a second fortune supplying equipment to the Russian army during the Crimean War in the 1850s. This was a man who was a ruthless, very fast-moving, entrepreneurial businessman. It seems he had few scruples. He then traveled to the United States, made more money supplying goods to gold miners during the gold rush, and then returned to Europe. From an early age, he'd been obsessed with Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. And increasingly, as he made more and more money and became more and more successful, he became obsessed more and more with discovering whether, in fact, these stories had any truth in them at all. Homer is oddly captivating. I was very lucky to be brought up on Homer in high school by a teacher, as I said, who could recite both in Greek fluently. But there's a difference between recitation and performance. And what this man did was perform Homer. He had the inflection of the voices. He could communicate pathos. He could communicate heroism. He could communicate happiness and sadness and mourning. He could communicate triumph. And he made it, the people, come alive. And I think it's very likely, because this enjoyment of Homer has been with me ever since, I think it's very likely that Schliemann was exposed in his youth to someone who could do the same. Because, you see, Homer was originally a set of oral poems which were recited at feasts and special occasions by wandering bards. And at some point, these, an amalgam of different legends, were written down and made into the great epic, the Iliad, which is the siege of Troy and a story of revenge and rivalry, and the Odyssey, which is the chronicle of the journeys of Odysseus returning home from the siege of Troy. And in 1863, his obsession took hold of him. At the age of 43, Heinrich Schliemann retired from business and took up archaeology full time. He divorced his first wife. He studied archaeology in London and Paris and Berlin. And then, having visited Greece several times, he embarked on a search for Homeric Troy. In 1871, Heinrich Schliemann married a young Greek girl, Sophia Engestramenos, who became his second wife. It seems to have been quite a love match, and she became his partner, trenching into the huge Hissarlik mound at the southern end of the Turkish Dardanelles. It's interesting to note, with the passage of generations, that Sophia outlived her husband and held court for generations of archaeologists in their magnificent house in Athens, where many of his finds were displayed. Schliemann's discovery of Troy is controversial. He traveled there looking, and he really had a belief that Homer was the literal truth, looking for a landscape. He wasn't looking so much at the city, although he was looking for the city, he was looking at the landscape, because in Homer there is a description of the surrounding topography, of the Scamander River, and of the various mounds and valleys and bays and so on. And Schliemann rode a horse over the countryside looking for the topography. And during these journeys, he met the American vice consul for the region, a gentleman called Frank Calvert. Calvert, who was interested in archaeology in Homer, had in fact done a little trenching into the nearby Hissarlik mound. And it was he that said, "Look, this site is Homer's Troy." And in fact, if you really want to get into it, Frank Calvert is the man who should claim the credit for finding Homeric Troy. But Schliemann took over. Now, Schliemann was a man who did nothing by halves. He had immense resources. He was completely self-financed. He did not, like Austin Henry Layard, have to rely on funding from the British Museum, which was ridiculously inadequate. He did not have to rely on the largesse of the French government like Emile Botta did. He had his own fortune. So he promptly hired engineers who had worked on the digging of the Suez Canal in Egypt to supervise his laborers. And in a maneuver that would set a modern archaeologist's hair on end, cut a huge trench through the center of Hissarlik. You can see it to this day. He passed through layer after layer of human occupation, city after city. He reached bedrock at 45 feet below the surface, a huge mound, a serried layers of occupation. The question was, which was the Homeric city, if this was Troy? Hissarlik was a city mound, and like all city mounds, it contained signs of building and rebuilding, of burning, and other signs of violent conflagration. Like a terrier, Schliemann identified the third city from the bottom as the Homeric town, largely because there were extensive signs of burning in the layers, and he said the Greeks burnt Troy. So here is the evidence of the siege. No one, not even by the most liberal interpretation, could at this point call Schliemann an archaeologist. He was a single-minded digger. His methods, for all his Suez Canal-trained engineers, were brutal. They were the methods of a quarryman. They were the methods of a pick and shovel. All he wanted to do was to find a city. He paid no attention to small artifacts or to stratified layers. He did no recording of his finds. Controversy dogged his excavations from the beginning. You can hardly blame his fellow archaeologists, if you would categorize him as such, of being doubtful of him. He was a brilliant self-publicist. He made startling claims which hit the headlines. Now, this was an era when the London Times, which was nicknamed the Thunderer, could depose prime ministers and swing public opinion overnight. There was no radio, there was no television, there were newspapers. Schliemann's discoveries were featured in the pages of the London Times. This gave him a cachet with the public, with the educated public, with political leaders, unheard of by many academics. So, any criticism of him tended to be at academic meetings or behind the scenes. This controversy over Schliemann was partly because his methods were so large and so noisy and so brutal. This in an era when the Germans in particular, and he was a German, were beginning to espouse much more scientific excavation methods, as we will see in a later lecture, and were beginning to place recording ahead of discovery. Schliemann put discovery ahead of recording. All he was interested in was finding Troy and proving it existed. Eventually, everyone came round to his viewpoint that Hissarlik was, in fact, the site of ancient Troy. There were no other convincing candidates. But few people accepted his notion that the third city was the Homeric one. His claims of the burning simply were too thin. Then another controversy erupted around Heinrich Schliemann. During the 1871 season, that's his first season, He found numerous gold artifacts. Now, Schliemann claimed that one day, when his workmen were working away, they came across, or he came across, a cache of gold. What appeared to be a bundle of shiny gold artifacts. He summoned Sophia, gave the workmen a break, and claimed that he had dug out this treasure and bundled it into her shawl, and that back in the excavation house, I dissected this and found a magnificent golden treasure. He carefully cleaned the finds, smuggled them illegally out of Turkey, which was highly illegal, even under the terms of the very liberal permit he had from the Sultan to work at Isselik. Then displayed the necklaces in the treasure on Sophia's neck and announced publicly that he had found the great treasure of King Priam, the king of Troy. The wrath of the Turkish government burst around Schliemann's shoulders. They claimed the treasure back. They demanded its return. He refused. The dispute went on and on. He was banned from digging further at Isselik, but he didn't care. Eventually, the golden treasure ended up in the Berlin Museum, but it vanished during World War II. And it was assumed that it was lost in the general destruction of 1945. But in fact, it surfaced in Russia at the end of the Cold War and now can be studied. Schliemann claimed that this was a single treasure. Now that the pieces have been thoroughly researched, and now that people have really combed through Schliemann's journals and papers, most people are absolutely convinced that, in fact, he took a whole lot of finds from many different levels and locations, and from them assembled his treasure. And the notion of a Priam's treasure today is discredited, even if the finds themselves are magnificent examples of Bronze Age artistry. Schliemann's publicity was unrelenting. He built up this image of himself in the press and through academic meetings and discussions, in interviews with journalists, as a man on a quest. His quest was to make Homer historical reality. Anyone who gave trouble, he would normally buy them off or ignore them. He settled the accusations of the Turks that he had smuggled out the treasure of Priam by simply paying a huge fine. While the dispute was going on, he went off on another series of excavations at Mycenae and Tiryns in Greece, which we'll describe in Lecture 12, where he found, in his quest for King Agamemnon, the Mycenaean civilization. But in 1878, he returned to Isselik for further excavations. This period was one of major change, and here we're really getting into this transition between adventure and digging, and adventure and the beginnings of scientific archaeology. Schliemann was a businessman, first and foremost. In a way, his campaign for Troy was a matter of profit and loss. The profit was the finding and the proving of Homer being right. The loss was the criticism. But constantly, he kept on battering at his notion that Isselik was Homer's city. German archaeologists began to take notice, but they were really concerned because they were beginning to develop much more scientific methods. They were beginning to observe the stratified layers in prehistoric and classical sites. As we will see in Lecture 13, they had begun a revolution in site exploration at Olympia and elsewhere in Greece, just as Schliemann's Troy excavations were receiving a lot of publicity. At Olympia, they were building museums, they were recording, they had an architect on site, all the things that Schliemann wasn't doing. Schliemann was literally an old-fashioned treasure hunter. And while his discoveries caused great sensation in public, among a public nurtured on Homer, archaeologists increasingly were saying, well, you may have found Troy, but unfortunately for science, Schliemann, who was now older and perhaps a little wiser, was persuaded to take some well-qualified archaeologists with him on his later Hissarlik campaigns. In 1878, for example, he worked with a German scholar called Rudolf Virchow, who studied the geology of the landscape around Troy. But his excavations were still crude. And it wasn't until 1888 to 1890, in his final work at Troy, that he brought in for the first time a well-trained young archaeologist who had worked at Olympia and was well-trained in stratified sites and the importance of small objects. This gentleman was another German. His name was Wilhelm Dorpfeld, whose career straddled the entire period between the treasure hunting and modern science. Dorpfeld was born in 1853, 20 years before the discovery of Hissarlik. He was brought up on the Olympia excavations. He died in 1940, an old man, at a time when science was really dominating archaeology, and anyone who excavated like Schliemann had would last about 5 minutes. His career straddled the period between the adventure and the science. So here, for the first time, we're beginning to get a link with the archaeology we know today. Because during Schliemann's life, archaeology changed dramatically and gradually became more and more the province of the scientist and the professional scholar than that of the amateur adventurer. Because in the final analysis, that is what Heinrich Schliemann was. Dorpfeld really took control of Troy, and they investigated anew the stratigraphy. And this time, although the excavations were crude by modern standards, Dorpfeld and Schliemann identified the sixth city from the top, not the third, as Homeric Troy, on the basis of the stone architecture. This conclusion has held well over the years. Heinrich Schliemann is somewhat of an enigma. His discoveries straddle a critical period of change in the history of the discovery of the ancient civilizations. On the one hand, he was ruthless, near megalomaniac, in his pursuit of Homer's Troy. He was also a mythmaker. He created this image of himself and his excavations, which probably bore little resemblance to truth. Calvert's legitimate claim to be the discoverer of Hissarlik was cast aside and has only recently come back into prominence. On the other hand, he is said to have been a kind and thoughtful man, although this certainly does not emerge that much from his biographies or from the records of contemporaries. even if he reinvented himself as a larger-than-life personality. And goodness knows, aren't we familiar with those sort of people in our world? His greatest legacy was the identification of Homeric Troy, which established that the Iliad had at least, just like the scriptures, some grounding in historical fact, even if the siege itself was a fiction. What Schliemann discovered was the brilliant Bronze Age cultures of Hisarlik, just as he discovered the Bronze Age cultures of Greece. He established the prehistory of the Aegean. It is unfortunate that the site in its pristine state was not excavated by modern archaeologists, but one of the tragedies of the discovery of early civilizations is that they were found 100 years too early, but you can equally well argue that if they hadn't been found, the modern scientific archaeology of today would not exist. So it's a catch-22. It's safe to say that without Heinrich Schliemann, archaeology in the late 19th century would have been very different, because he thought on a scale and with a boldness that was becoming increasingly rare among archaeologists. Because the other trend that was beginning to happen was the beginnings of specialization. Today's archaeology is an arcane skill, and there are specialists in archaeology in all kinds of obscure subjects. There were Egyptologists, there were experts on Coptic Egypt, there were Sumeriologists, Assyriologists, experts on Akkadian, experts on medieval rabbit keeping in northeastern England, experts on Ice Age earthworms, experts on minute details of pottery from Central America or the American Southwest. You need an expert in archaeology on something, you will find it. We have got more and more and more specialized. This is a product of the greater impact of science on archaeology. It is an impact of a far more complicated world, and it's also a consequence of the fact that we now know a great deal more about the past than we used to. For example, there were now scholars who were studying the role of women in ancient Egypt in minute detail, using hard evidence. Someone like Heinrich Schliemann or John Lloyd Stevens or Austin Henry Layard would consider such research unimaginable, because they were concerned with the spectacular discovery, with the basic identification, with the basic problem of what's out there. They were finding entire civilizations. Today, we found the civilizations. What we're now doing is trying to put our minds into the middle of them to understand how they really worked and functioned. Not the kings, not the great high priests and the nobles, but a society of individuals and groups who lived and died and interacted with each other and between them created these societies. In short, we're looking at the dynamics of early civilizations, why they came into being, how they became complex, how they developed, and how they collapsed or survived. These questions are far more interesting than whether Homer actually existed or whether Troy was an actual siege, which were the questions that obsessed Heinrich Schliemann. He was the last of the great amateur discoverers, the last of the adventurers. Few excavators ever excavated so many spectacular finds or found so many important sites. Few excavators had his vision, his boldness, his charisma, which is a critical ingredient in archaeological discovery. But by the time he died in 1890, he was an anachronism, because science was increasingly taking over the role of discovery of ancient civilization. So in a way, he's a sort of symbol of a world that was rapidly vanishing. In the next lecture, we'll take a look at his other discoveries the shaft graves at Mycenae and the Mycenaean civilization, the brilliant Bronze Age civilization of Greece, the discovery of which we do indeed owe to this most remarkable, visionary, and controversial of early discoverers.